The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the third in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Maurice, we've been talking about the difference between subjects when seen from a purely political point of view and from the point of view that we assume to be more basic than that, namely the religious point of view or the point of view that was developed and evolved, as it were, in the Bible. And we've talked about various matters in that light. We've talked about democracy and certain aspects of democracy. Let me ask you this. Have you often been impressed in recent years, when men have been searching for some kind of answer to totalitarianism, have you been impressed by the frequency with which they invoke a phrase that to them seems to have a great deal of meaning, the dignity of the individual? They claim that in the totalitarian states, the dignity of the individual is not recognized, and they desire that it should be recognized, and of course one agrees with that. But isn't it often doubtful to you that they know what the ultimate reference is?
I must say that the word dignity, although I recognize its good purpose, is insufficient. Dignity itself is a civic term, often has to do with civic relations. And my feeling is that behind it there should stand at least the recognition of the sanctity of the individual.
Excellent. I prefer that word myself, but you never hear it used.
And I think that is a shortcoming in modern discussion, unless they choose, which can be done, unless they choose to invest the word dignity with the idea of sanctity rather than with status. Dignity smacks to me a little of status.
Yes, although it originally, I believe, included or somehow or other contained the idea of honor, which might be very good indeed.
Well, then again, the word honor, too, is dubious. We are, I think, in this small matter, apparently verbal, really touching on the basis of our discussion. Dignity I look upon as secular, and sanctity, naturally, as being sacred. So that if we could make the word dignity imply not just a man's relationship to other men in terms of acknowledgement, but in terms of his inmost worth, and of course dignity meant worth originally, then I would agree that the use of the phrase so spread and so understood is of great value.
Yes, sanctity I infinitely prefer to dignity. But there we are on the verge of having to consider, which I want very much to consider, that famous ancient doctrine of the equality of men. We have referred to it here before when we talked about how Jefferson and Lincoln, to name no other American statesman, made the statement which they expected to be understood somehow or other, that all men are created equal. I'm sure that both Jefferson and Lincoln understood that. I think their understanding was deep. Many persons, however, do not understand it, do not believe it. They toss it off as just one of those things that politicians
say.
Yes,
but Mark, there is a sense in which human beings are not born equal. One man is born with a tendency to grow taller than another, or more agile, or perhaps has a greater capacity for brain development, and there's a confusion in the public mind as to what is meant by equal, so they deny it and they're arguing on different grounds.
Yes, whereas if you use the word sanctity, which you have and which I want to use from this moment on, you are referring to something that is inviolable in every person. As a matter of fact, I would prefer to the word individual also the word person.
Yes, I would.
It seems to me the same.
And I would
have
used another word. You've suggested inviolable is better than, what does the Constitution say? Unalienable, right?
Yes.
Now, unalienable means that it's something attached to the person and that one can, by an artificial act, take it away from him. But here is something that we have to assume cannot, by an artificial act, be taken away. It's inviolable in the very deep meaning of that, a very deep sense of that word.
And it, in my understanding, the Bible is drenched everywhere with an understanding of this, with an understanding of the principle that in God's mind, all persons, all human persons, are sacred.
Because they're his.
Because they're his sons.
Yes.
Or because they are his. Or...
And because he admonishes them that when it comes, as it were, if I may use the phrase, to a showdown, it's to him they appeal.
Yes.
There's a constitution to appeal to, but then in the end he says that the man who is oppressed, or the man who is being... whose substance is being stolen, he will appeal to me and I will hear him.
Yes.
This direct contact is what I call the inviolability.
That's right. I will hear him because he is mine and because he exists. By right of existence, we become sacred in his view. I've always been interested in a verse out of the book of Proverbs, which has no preface and no explanation afterwards. It just stands there suddenly. The rich and the poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all.
Yes.
They're very moving thing for some reason about that. The Lord is the maker of them all, and therefore they will meet together.
Notice, by the way, an implication there, too, is that the poor man must not feel himself ipso facto spiritually superior to the rich man.
Yes.
There are frequent warnings in the Bible that you mustn't cater to the poor man in his poverty as such.
That's
as,
right.
For example, when the law lays it down, that you must not divert the law to the poor.
That's right. You must remember that all men are equal on some level other than riches, and maybe on some level other than intelligence, too. But by sheer virtue of our existence, we are all the same. Our likeness to one another is more important than our differences.
Well, I'll tell you what I find encouraging, deeply encouraging, in a biblical outlook. And that is that the view of man in his equality is tacitly asserted in a messianic, an ultimate messianic framework. That is to say, that all are participants in the movement toward perfection. In democracy, we generally take, and again tacitly, the lowest common denominator as being the measure. That what the poorest man has, the wealthiest man has, in the light of the law or in the light of social adjustment. But there is not implicit in democracy the elan or the thrust whereby the most humble are participants in an ultimate messianic perfection. Tell me what you think of that, because there's a passage I want to read to you having the bearing on this distinction between the democratic and the biblical evaluation of man.
By the way, yes, I'll answer that in a minute. By the way, we're not suggesting, are we, when we say that the biblical estimate of things transcends the democratic one, that the democratic one isn't very precious in itself. We are grateful, aren't
we? Well, we've made it explicit, in fact, that if the two are not interlinked, then the democratic is worthless.
That's right. And that the language in which democratic thoughts and feelings are expressed, if that language seems neutral and pale, it can only be because we can suspect that in the mind of the speaker of the language, the maker of the language, the ultimate source, which is glory and sanctity, is somehow absent. But we certainly, all of us, owe more than we can say to democracy, even in its palest form, even in its most neutral form. It has changed the world, has it not? Surely. Surely it has made a world in which you and I are free to move and have our being to whatever extent we do, and millions and millions and millions of others. And we can all remember times, I don't mean literally remember, but we know of times in history when very, very few persons had privilege.
Yes, but there is another danger that confronts us in what I would call the static concept of democracy, and that is people seeing themselves in this vast aggregation of human beings with their personality reduced by a statistical view of the human condition. The passage I was going to read to you, if you'll let me, is from Logan Pearsall Smith's Trivia.
Oh, yeah.
I came across it as a perfect expression of how, though humorously put, the tragic condition of men in the modern world can be expressed. This is what he writes. Where do I come in? When I read in the Times about India and all its populations and problems, when I look at the letters in large type of important personages and find myself face to face with questions, movements, and great activities of the age, where do I come in, I ask myself uneasily. Then, in the great Times-reflected world, I find the corner where I play my humble part, for I am one of the unpraised, unrewarded millions without whom statistics would be a bankrupt science. It is we who are born, who marry, who die in constant ratios, who regularly lose so many umbrellas, post just so many unaddressed letters every year, and there are enthusiasts among us who, without the least thought of their personal convenience, allow omnibuses to run over them or throw themselves month by month from the London bridges. Now, this is humorously put, but behind it is the tragedy of the feeling that in democracy, this is what human beings are reduced to. They are the statistical averages. Now, this is what can happen in the democratic concept when it is robbed of the dynamism of a biblical background.
That's right. And so, I'll always be grateful to the prophet Ezekiel for having put these words into the mouth of the Lord once. Is it my way that is not equal? He says, speaking to the house of Israel. Is it my way that is not equal? Is it not your ways that are unequal? There is the Lord saying to the people, you practice inequality. You assume inequality. I do not. You do not understand equality as I understand it.
You know, it's a curious thing. Now, this is a bit of a digression. You're talking of the prophet Ezekiel.
Yes.
It's often occurred to me that there is a philosophic streak, a social philosophic streak in Ezekiel that is stronger than in the other prophets. He was a mystic. He was a man who had visions, and as a matter of fact, on the text of the book of Ezekiel, much of the Kabbalah and much of the fantasy of the Kabbalah is based. Nevertheless, you find this sort of purely philosophic reflection, just as you find in him his repudiation of the old concept of guilt of the children because of the fathers. When he says, the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. There is, in the middle of his fantasy, a sudden sobriety of statement that is almost as if he were a dual personality. But I think your quotation is very apt there.
Well, now, you spoke of that quality in Ezekiel. It's also by the evidence of just one verse, for me, at any rate, present in Jeremiah, who was protesting once against the notion that one cannot know God unless one has been taught how to do it. There are those who tell you how to know God. He says, he's putting words into God's mouth. He has God say this, they shall all know me from the least of them unto the greatest. In other words, God is saying, it is not supremely difficult to know me. Any of my sons can know me if he only will. There is no discipline required. There is no preparation for it. All men can. To me, this is thrillingly relevant to what I have referred to as the doctrine of equality. Seems to me if the word equality means anything, and I'm now putting it on, if you like, entirely secular grounds, it means this, as a philosopher friend of mine once pointed out. It needs to mean only this. All men are equal. That is to say, all men are alike in that they possess the human mind, which is not possessed by any other creature. It is only human beings who have the human mind, and all human beings have it. It is what makes them human. Now, some of them may use it more than others. Some of them may use it less than others. But any distinguished person, any distinguished poet, statesman, or whatnot, I believe takes it for granted that it's possible for him to be understood by anyone who listens. Anyone using that thing in him, which I have called the human mind. That is the one thing that is not absent in any of us.
Well, this idea that you're now expounding is mirrored again in Ezekiel.
Ezekiel?
Again in Ezekiel, when he talks of the human being as being every human being having the redeemability of his proper self. In the verse, in chapter 19, he says, Have I any pleasure at all that the wicked should die? Meaning the wicked man should die, and not that he should return from his ways and live? A man cannot have gone so far that he cannot be pulled back, is the implication. Mm-hmm. That is to say, Mark, that the human being as an impotentialities, here it's used in the sense of salvation, let us talk of it in the use of rehabilitation. The human being has all these potentialities, and there the equality lies. All of us have it in sufficient measure to pull us back from the brink of disaster.
And Maurice, that must have been what Jefferson was referring to when he said, the people are somehow safe. We are safe with the people. In other words, we may count on them to understand. Some of them may be wiser than others. Some of them may be more informed than others. Some may study more than others. But the potentiality of understanding is in all. I believe Jefferson lived in that faith. It is what inspired him to do what he did in the field of education. It's what inspired him, maybe as he wrote the Declaration of Independence, a faith in the human capacity, which some men, by the way, do not have. I suspect that, by and large, it is the superior person who most easily understands the doctrine of equality, the one who is least afraid of losing anything by understanding it.
Well, the application of the principle is so exhausting, actually, that we sometimes fall away from it simply because we haven't got the strength.
And by the way, Maurice, let me ask you this, too, before I get off this topic. I seem to be sort of going down a list of references and quotations today, but these really are bursting within me. How do you understand the psalmist when he says in the 18th psalm, thy gentleness, sometimes the word is translated thy condescension. Thy condescension, thy gentleness, thy goodness, whatever it may be, hath made me great.
How do I understand that?
Yes.
I suppose that in infusing your spirit into me, you have made me something like yourself.
Yes, you have left me in no doubt about myself.
That it comes from you, that there is no greatness except that which comes from him.
And, of course, that has reference to something that all human beings understand. If I am doubted by others who are close to me or who are in authority over me or whatnot, if I am doubted by others and constantly judged by them and watched to see if I'm going to make mistakes, I lose a great deal. I become less great. Whereas I tend to be more great if I detect in those about me faith in me and confidence in me. Isn't that, among other things, what the psalmist is saying?
Well, the reason men have recourse to prayer is that they do want to get away from the censoriousness of men to the much wider and deeper, chesed, you would call it. I don't know what word you're referring to, the graciousness of God, that he does know our weaknesses, but he doesn't take an attitude of censoriousness to those. He is willing to help. This is the attitude, and one turns to him instead of to men.
Yes, and the psalmist says in the 145th Psalm, the Lord is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all his works. Something to me very moving and beautiful about that.
Yes, over his works, meaning that the world itself is geared to be helpful to man and to bring out his qualities. When we speak of this equality in man, we are up against the dreadful problem, it's as old as any discussion of social relationships, what this equality actually means. Democracy always faces the dilemma of the inner danger. I think we discussed it last week, that democracy doesn't mean letting the mass of people follow any impulse that happens to arise at a given moment. John Stuart Mill has a passage in which he says, let us emphasize to man and society the importance of giving full freedom to human nature to expand itself in innumerable and conflicting directions. That is to say, to put it colloquially, everything goes. In an equal society, every man, so it seems, has the right to his opinion. Well, there's a limitation on that phrase, isn't there? I'm entitled to my opinion. Am I always entitled to my opinion?
Oh, yes. Oh, it seems to me there's no limitation there. Of course you're entitled to your opinion. What I think you may have in mind is this. You're not entitled, I'm sure you agree, to assume that because it's your opinion, it's a good one.
No, I'll go further than that. Am I entitled to a hearing? Supposing I'm asked about... Now, what is your opinion of this particular law, the agricultural bill that's now pending? And my knowledge of it is, well, to say that it's nil is in itself an overstatement.
Well, of course...
Now, am I entitled to an opinion in that sense?
Well, you spoke either last week or the week before about polls. I think you even used the sacred word gallop. I've never forgotten being stopped on the street once in New York and asked by some man who whipped out a notebook whether I wanted to answer 14 questions on public utilities. And I said, why are you asking this? And he said, well, this is a Gallup poll, and I'm canvassing opinion on a certain matter now at issue with respect to utilities, whether they should be privately or publicly owned and that sort of thing. And I said, well, my dear man, I haven't any opinion at all. Not only could I not answer 14 questions, I couldn't answer one with any sense that I had a right to.
But you know, you were depriving this man of his livelihood.
Of course I was. He was
going to go around with this modesty of yours, your proper modesty. What's going to happen to the whole of our system?
Well, he closed his notebook very sadly, but I imagine he did find enough people to come back with some kind of answers, and those were tabulated, and someday, a week later, or a month later, or a year later, it was declared that the people of the United States, according to a sampling that was taken of them, believe so-and-so about utilities. Well, now...
Well, it's a very reliable sampling of a worthless quantity.
Well, I think we are sort of degrading the word opinion when it comes to that, because that is not a thing that an opinion about would be, it seems to me, very important. I mean that public utilities do not have their importance, but surely opinion on them would have to be informed, wouldn't it? It would have to be disciplined in some sense. Otherwise, it would just make no sense at all. There are lots of very, very great and deep public subjects which I think we should consult everybody about. My objection is to the man who, when he has given his opinion and you say with the best will in the world that you think it's worthless, says, well, nevertheless, I had a right to say that. Well, of course he had a right to say it, but so have you a right to judge the opinion.
Let's go down a little bit deeper and collate this question with situations that have arisen in the Bible. Every man is entitled to his opinion. We talk of free speech. We have placed politically or according to social law limitations on free speech. You can't shout fire in a theater. You can't, use free speech where it can lead immediately to riot. You cannot incite to violence. A man may have the opinion that the best way to solve the present social problem is to arm 100,000 men in America to go around bashing everybody on the head. He has that opinion. Is he permitted to go about and say so? Or is he permitted to say, let you and I, addressing a little mob, let you and I go out and bash people around? He is not. Now, in the Bible, there is a similar prohibition, and that is to deny God. Because there the last law is, it is on God's will and on the existence of God that the whole structure of society, as well as of the universe, that the whole structure of society rests. Well, we put a limit on free speech in the sense I indicated before. The Bible put a limit on free speech in that sense. We don't do it nowadays. We allow a man to go around and say there is no God. Mm-hmm. Probably because the effect of believing in God has so substantially founded society that there is no danger now, such as there might have been then, of action following on this disbelief. Mm. But some such principle remains, doesn't it?
Well,
a limitation of expression of opinion.
Well, Maurice, I am always uncomfortable when I'm asked whether there shouldn't be some limitation to free speech. I think there should be none at all. There isn't anything that couldn't be considered inciting to something, to somebody, when one of the presidents of the United States, I've forgotten which one, toward the end of the 19th century, was assassinated. The assassin was found to have a certain magazine in his pocket. And it was assumed that that magazine was responsible for the death of the president. It doesn't seem to me that that follows. An editorial in the New York Times in a day could move some maniac to assassinate somebody, you know.
I understand.
A public official would be criticized, and somebody might be fool enough or insane enough to go and shoot that official in the belief that he needed to die. I think it's terribly dangerous to...
Yes, I'm not...
To limit free speech.
I don't suppose any thinking person has ever come to a cast iron opinion on this question, and I quite understand that the abuse of a good principle is no reason for the abrogation of the principle.
I believe that you lose more. I believe that society loses more by the suppression of free speech at any moment than it ever does by the thing, through the thing that is said. No matter how evil it is.
Let's take a simple case of what I would call an abuse of free speech which I wouldn't repress. We are told in Deuteronomy, "Thou shalt not oppress a hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he is of thy brethren or of the stranger within thy land, lest he cry against thee to the Lord." Now, there's a sentence.
Yeah.
Supposing a man gets up and says, "Thou shalt oppress thy hired servant," especially if he's poor and needy, because it shows that he can't take care of himself,
mm-hmm.
and his poverty is obviously the result of his wickedness, and this namby-pamby attitude toward the sick and the suffering is one of the evidences of the decadence of this country. Well, I wouldn't object to that man going around and saying these things. Of course, I wouldn't provide him with a platform either.
Yes.
I don't consider that part of the free speech. Now, there, obviously, you can't, shouldn't prevent the man. But supposing the man goes around buttonholing people and saying, "Let's go and kill that man."
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to hit sometime upon somebody who'll say, "Yes, let's do it, for the thrill of it." Now, what do you do in a case like that? Mm-hmm. Is he free to do that? There is a limit. We have tremendous difficulty in finding it. The Bible recognized the limit. We may not use it anymore today. It recognized the limit, and there it is.
Hmm. I suppose practically there is some limit. I think it's maybe beyond our present point. I am terribly reluctant to state it or to think that it can be stated. However, that's another question altogether. I think that we must have agreed today that it's an act of faith to say that all men are created equal. Not an act of reason.
No, the deepest act of faith.
Just heard "The Words We Live By," the third in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. "The Words We Live By" is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.